were right at the inflection point of the election, actually. Right when, in a normal circumstance, with a playing field that's even, that has at least 5% chunked and formed sanity in it, this is my favorite part of the election cycle right now, is when, you know, the dead weight is starting to clear away. Everybody's like, okay, no, I'm actually, there's no chance in heck I'm going to win the presidency, and they drop out. And then the incumbent decides now is the time to suddenly rediscover themselves as the candidate they were 4 years ago. And I that's always a fun part, because it's like it's situational psychosis writ large, writ national. It's a situational psychosis that could literally end the world. Welcome to Ask an Atheist with me, Sam Mulvey, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. That is our voicemail number, toll-free nationwide. Joining me today is Luke. How you doing?
Not too bad. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm awake. And Dan, how's it going?
Just happy to be here.
Fantastic. Yeah, this is another one of those things where I'm working in the other room, and Becky's like, can you do a thing on your radio show? I'm like, yeah, I suppose I ought.
You mean Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey?
Yeah, I still think that was a poor decision on my part. But so a lot going on today. So let's get this out of the way. You know, God, it's a shame I can't add reverb right at the board, because generally you don't need reverb in a talk show, but I would really add it right now. I hereby order all Americans to buy me a factory or something in Nally Valley for nefarious electromagnetic purposes. Also, I am the king of Tacoma.
Oma.
Exactly. Yeah, because that's what we do now, is we now live in a society where rules and laws about commerce are passed to us via Twitter. Because did you know about this?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Could you tell me what this is? Because I'm having difficulty understanding it, other than making fun of it.
So apparently the president believes a 1977 law allows him to dictate what corporations are allowed to do internationally, or nationally, I suppose, even.
Okay.
Yay.
How? What 1977 law?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact law.
Was this the one about, like, not riding an ugly horse down Main Street on Sunday?
Yeah. No fishing in the water tower?
What? You have my attention.
You shouldn't. No.
Yeah. It, apparently, like, that's the weird thing, yeah, is that we have a situation where the president believes he can like summon troops via Twitter.
Well, I think that's been the case this entire presidency.
Yeah. Well, he kind of backed off on it for a few years when he actually had to, like, do the job of being the president as much as he was capable of doing the job. But this is the inflection point of the election. This is the point where the president feels like they have to go and be the person they were in 2015 and 2016 in order to get the next 4 years. So all the insanity that we've been anticipating is now here. And what I really like about it, and what I've really enjoyed about it so far, is just how at least the vocal electorate has really kind of adapted. Now what happens is he does something stupid, like orders corporations to stop selling with China right now, as if that wouldn't, like, grind American commerce to a halt.
Right.
And we all go, yeah, kids in cages. Like, the politics of creating an event, a media event, a 72-hour media cycle that CNN and MSNBC and Fox News can follow, that isn't working on the low key, on the low end. You need to actually create an actual crisis for those 72-hour news cycles to work. Because now everybody seems to go, ha ha, that's funny. Racism? You know, and that's, I like that. Like, we can acknowledge that something is funny. We can acknowledge the idiocy of the president, but it isn't taking anybody's minds off of what's actually going on either side. I have to admit, on the side of the people who think kids in cages is a bad idea and racism is a failed philosophy and terrible and, you know, whatever. And, the people who don't think that or Fox News viewers,
a third of the country.
A third of the country. Yeah, 33% of the country. Great. Fantastic. If the stakes weren't so damn high, I would really be enjoying it, because I think it's the first time in my life the actual discourse of American politics has fundamentally changed between two election presidential election cycles. Right now, people are talking about how he ordered corporations to do that, but that's your opener. That's like, say, your first 5 minutes of your talk show. But then you immediately turn around and go back to what you were doing.
What, like talking about indefinite detentions being a thing again?
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that that's actually changed in American political discourse, I think, is a step in the right direction. I'm really enjoying this, and I need to find good things where I can find them. I don't know that it's going to work everywhere, but I am in fact the chosen one. Just to see, you know, I have been on top of the mountain. I have seen all the lands of the earth, and I have returned, and now I am the chosen one. In fact, when the time comes, I won't need to dodge bullets.
Do you know Kung Fu?
No. Well, I might know Kung Fu. Yeah,
all
maybe.
All right.
So you'll be able to do the hand in front of you thing and just stop them?
Yeah. Pseudo no more bullets. works pretty good. They're doing another Matrix movie.
I saw that.
What?
Yeah. Yes. Matrix 4. Carrie Ann Moss and
Lana Wachowski and Keanu Reeves
are all coming back.
Which means I think we have to ignore the Morp guy now. Because apparently the online role-playing game of The Matrix was supposed to be the official continuance of the story, but that closed up a good 15 years ago now, so...
Okay, well, I didn't even know there was one.
Yeah.
What did Disney do with the expanded universe?
Fair. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically. Well, I know they had recently worked with J. Michael Straczynski of Babylon 5, one of my favorite Ooh. Science fiction shows. I know they'd worked on some other show. And I'm like, oh, does this mean there's going to be JMS-ness in The Matrix? And then I thought about that. I'm like, is that actually a good thing? That might not be a good thing. That could be a bad thing. I don't know. I don't know what to do when the president says he's the king of Israel.
And the chosen one. Did you see the clip? I am blah, 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 blah. The chosen one looking off into space and turning back around.
That's the thing, is that he's now saying he meant it sarcastically. And when I saw the clip, I could say that. Like, that's something I would, like, that's a joke I make, is when somebody comes on, Sam, you have to fix all of the things, which happens to me a lot as a professional troubleshooter. Even outside of my professional life, people show up and are like, hey, go fix the thing. And I just look at them and then I stare off into space and I say, for he is the Kwisatz Haderach. You know, that's a joke I would make.
Yeah.
But I'm joking, and he's like, it's helicopter time for one thing. It's what they do in place of a press conference. And he does, like, his eyes glaze over and he stares off into space. And, just last week, we were talking about how Jim Baker was making a gold coin with his face and Cyrus 2, this time it's personal, on it, that Christians are supposed to pray to. So, like, nobody's actually praying to me. Like, or, geez, I hope not. That would be super weird. But
I mean, if anybody out there is willing to start.
No.
We'll never actually know.
Yeah, no. There are people who have promised that they would... That they'd call in hitmen if I ever started a religion. No, as far as I'm aware, there's no one praying to me. Trump can't say that.
No, not even a little bit.
Yeah. Trump knows people are praying to him. And he's precisely the kind of personality who would can I say
Shazbot
on that on the air? Because that's kind of what it is.
Mm.
Well, yeah. He loves his ego being stroked.
Yeah. That's what it is. I want to, you know, I don't know what kind of comedy you can make out of it that hasn't already been made and made better by actual comedians who are paid to be funny. The other side of it, though, is there does the shift in American politics. The like maybe this is step one on America becoming an adult.
I can hope, but
yeah,
we have a couple of paths we can take.
Right. Well, I mean, we're at the 12 years old now, and
yeah,
you know, now we're gonna have the American Goth phase, and where we have pitchforks.
I really thought 2016 was gonna be the rock bottom, but we have been digging,
yeah,
like against all semblances of sanity.
Mm-hmm.
We've actually managed to get worse.
So let's stick with good news. Day before yesterday, there was the I don't know if it's now the biggest rivalry in MLS, or wait, is Dave listening? In the MLS? Yes. Okay. It's an in-joke. apparently, you're supposed to call it MLS, not the MLS, and calling it the MLS makes you an outsider.
This is soccer.
This is soccer.
Okay.
This is soccer. Major League Soccer, MLS. Ah. Yes. So it was the Sounders and the Timbers. It's the Portland-Seattle game, which for a long time was the biggest rivalry and is now among the biggest rivalries in MLS. And there's been an ongoing political thing and ongoing racism thing in MLS. Are you familiar with the... Oh, crap. What is it? The Iron Guard? Iron Front. Thank you. Becky is helping me. The Iron Front. It was this thing where racists showed up at the Sounders game a couple weeks ago, started a physical altercation. It was kind of a bad deal. And then Iron Front, there were Iron Front flags in the stadium, and there was like anti-fascism flags in the stadium. And MLS said, these are political signs, and we don't allow political signs in the stadium. And everybody's like, wait, being against fascism and racism is considered a political statement in this case? That's weird.
Well, yeah. In this political climate, it's not inaccurate.
But the thing is MLS has been fairly bad about this. And I purport in my completely naive way that it's because of their connection with FIFA, an organization that...
FIFA.
Which is, I don't care for an organization. It's actually, FIFA has long been the reason why I haven't paid attention to soccer at all. But the Sounders themselves have usually been pretty good about this stuff. And this was a bit of a turnaround. And I really wish Dave were here because he could explain it. However, the good news is, so this big rivalry game happens, right? And I'm watching it at a bar in Tacoma. Because somebody at camp told me they had beer Slurpees. And I wanted to try it.
How were they?
Since it was a Ghost, or however you pronounce it. It was a sour beer.
Yeah.
It worked really well.
Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah, it was margarita-ish.
Oh, yes.
That sounds all right.
Yeah, so I wanted to try it. It was somebody at camp who hasn't been on the air, so I won't name them. And so I went there, and I'm having a beer Slurpee, and I'm watching TV, and then the game comes on. The Sounders Timbers game. I'm like, wait, is this live? And I go, hey guys, is this live? And yes. So I buy a six pack and I immediately head to Dave and Carol's because if this is in Portland, means they're at home, which means I can watch an important game with Dave and Carol, which is always a blast. It's like hands-free football is happening in your face. and so we're watching this game and I sit down and I didn't hear because it's a bar. I didn't hear the audio at the bar. And I'm watching the game, and Dave's like, do you notice something different, Sam? He said, and he's like, this is a rivalry game, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, yeah, something's not right. And then he starts reading a press release at me, and it's all of the fan groups. And the minute he said all of the fan groups, it's like, that was just the data I needed. It was like a golf game. Like, there was very little noise, very little, applause. There were no flags out. No TIFOs. I don't know. Not my language. But this is a game where people go all out to show off with their flags and their costumes and all that stuff. And it was like watching golf on the Golf Channel. It was practically silent to the point where the play-by-play folk were like, yeah, do we have to screw with the sound again? It's pretty quiet here. And then Dave read the press release to it, which is all of the supporters groups, all of them, for the Timbers, for the Sounders, signed a joint statement saying that, in response to the teams and the league's response to the Iron Front flags, we are going to protest the first 33 minutes of the game. We are not going to protest. We will not cheer. There will be no flags. There will be nothing. Both sides, all groups, first 33 minutes.
Wow.
And yeah, minute 33 hit, and it got loud. And then Iron Front flags were out, anti-fascist flags were out. It was everywhere. You got the sense that maybe the TV producers really wanted to get a shot of this because it was important, but management was like, no, we can't show that. So it was like, there were bunches of great shots of the protest flags, and then there were no shots of the protest flags like 5 minutes later. But you can't hide the sound. You know what I mean? You can try piping in sound, but it's not the same. You can tell. And that was a pretty great moment for me. People were willing to make that kind of protest when their favorite teams made the wrong call. Mm. And I think the fact that they said the first 33 minutes of the game, which, by the way, was a reference to the disbanding of the Iron Front in 1933. So it was an important number.
Hmm.
But I think it would have worked better I think it worked better waiting the first 33 minutes than if they just blanked on the game or something like that. Because you had a third of the game where the crowd just didn't seem like they were watching something else. You know what I mean? They sounded like a baseball crowd. It's my sport. I can make that joke. And it was just dead. And then watching the game and then knowing what's going on because it's all over the internet. And then at the 33 minute, it's like somebody flipped a switch and now it's actually a soccer game again. That was such a bigger display, I think, than if you just blanked on the whole game and didn't have anything.
Yeah.
That was super cool.
The fact that they were able to actually organize that to keep everybody from doing anything for 33 whole minutes is pretty spectacular.
The level of organization involved in these supporters groups I've always found a little strange.
Yeah.
And I would make fun of it. I don't do that anymore because look at what they're doing with it. Like, they're picking up where really, like, when the league falls down, the supporters groups are bringing them to task. And that's amazing. I really like that.
Got to use your powers for good.
And with everything going on in Seattle and everything going on in Portland, where the cops seem to be in on it.
Right.
Yeah, about that.
Well, a little closer to home. I don't know how much closer to home you get than Seattle and Portland. How about Tacoma? The Archdiocese of Seattle has announced plans to permanently close and demolish Tacoma's Holy Rosary Church after determining the repairs and upgrades to the tune of $18 million were too much for the parish to handle. Canon law dictates that this is the responsibility of parishes to maintain their buildings. The century-old neo-Gothic building has not been occupied since October, when chunks of its plaster ceiling fell onto the choir loft. Seattle Archbishop Peter Sartain, I remember that guy, he's not that great, issued a decree in accordance with the recommendations of an advisor team and contractors who analyzed the structure. The last major renovation had taken place in 1994, when the copper roof was installed. Future land use will be determined by the parish and the archdiocese.
Okay, so when somebody says the last time repairs happened was 1994,
yeah,
I think, oh, that's not that long ago. Yeah, it is.
It is now.
That's
like 25 years ago.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, that's closer to the construction of the Great Wall of China than it is to us. That might not be true. Yeah, well, I mean, okay, that church is a major landmark, and it's a major landmark in my neighborhood. Like, right. I drive past it when I go to one of the places I work.
It's a beautiful building.
It's a really nice building. It's the type of construction that can't be anything other than a church. I mean, it'd be a great antenna mast, don't get me wrong, but it's definitely a church. And everybody's... I get it. It's a landmark. It's been a part of Tacoma for a long time. But we don't own it, and a church owns it, and so I'm reading all this stuff on like local Facebook and local Twitter and whatnot, and I'm like, this is an organization that doesn't care about you in the big things. Like, this is an organization that sees the failure of American healthcare and decides that buying in and profiting off of it is the best way to go. This is an organization that protects cardinals and is currently, right this second, elsewhere in the world, protecting cardinals from facing the law that when they allow rape to happen in their diocese. This is an organization that has strategically bound its charitable work with its political ideology and demands that in order to receive their aid, demands in places where they can, that you kowtow, literally bow to them in order to receive help from them. So why would an organization designed off of this structure, built off of this structure, want to help you fix a church that they don't care about?
No.
Yeah. I mean, on some level, I get it. It's a historical building. Unlike Seattle, Tacoma likes to preserve its historical buildings. And I understand the argument. But on the other side, on the other side of it, I'm me, and this is a church, and I don't care about it.
I would honestly love to get my hands on an old church and live in it.
Not that kind of church, though, because that's such bad use of land.
You're not wrong.
Right. It's total ostentation there, and not every cathedral is like that. Some of them have the big pointy structure and all the cool art stuff, and then are also used. But that's a really tiny, that's a really tiny place. But yeah, taking over a church and turning it into something weird has long been something I wanted to do.
That's definitely something I want to do.
You can have it desecrated, and then you could live up in the loft and take out all the pews below, and you can store your garbage down there, so you wouldn't have to take it out for a very long time.
What's worse?
Maybe not until Thanksgiving, even.
Is there a procedure for desecrating? I don't know.
I believe there is.
Okay.
There is.
What's worse, if you do it or if you don't?
It makes no difference to me.
I don't know. The whole reason I care about church properties in this way is that they are designed to serve a community. So as it happens, they tend to make really good community centers. Mm-hmm. If you can get them. They also tend to be very expensive.
Yes.
And require a lot of work, because funny thing about a church is that code organizations tend to look the other way when it's a church.
Also,
if you're serving God, you don't need to ground your outlets. That's fine.
Volunteer work tends to be shoddy at best in those.
Yes, absolutely. And it's almost always our volunteer work. So it's like there are problems with these buildings, but if properly cared for, they could make great community centers. And so I wouldn't personally be in favor of demolishing a church, but it's not like this church would be repaired and then turned into a homeless shelter or something like that. This would just continue to be a functional church. And it's like, okay, that's cool. I don't care.
I'm puzzled by the price tag when they're saying, the repairs and upgrades would be $18 million. And the church is just down the road from here. We've all seen it dozens of times.
Right.
It's not that big.
No.
And it's ornate, but it's not $18 million ornate. I feel like you could completely bulldozer the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And rebuild a newer and much more ornate for less than $18 million.
And that's probably the thinking of the diocese, I'm thinking.
Yeah. There's probably some hazardous materials mitigation they have to deal with. Mm.
It might be before wide use of asbestos, but it's not going to be before use of lead everywhere.
No, it's probably lead paint and everything.
The other thing is that it's old enough, it probably has no earthquake protection, and that's a tall freestanding structure. So,
fair point.
I'm thinking
unsupported brick walls.
Yeah. And Becky is again yelling at me in chat. It's 8 stories high, which is a resonant frequency of some earthquakes, which could be a problem. I was figuring a building that old and that tall, most of that $18 million would probably go towards basically rebuilding it anyway.
Right.
And I know there's people out there who want to do historical, who are willing to save a historical building at all costs. For me, people are too high a cost for saving historical buildings. So if it's unsafe, then it's got to go. And so I wasn't when the Luzon building here was torn down, which was a historical building with some incredible architecture in it. But it was unsafe, literally to its foundation, and had a 4-story tree growing out of it in the middle of downtown Tacoma.
Oh.
I'm it would have been nice to save. Nice to save was 10 years ago. It should probably be torn down now. And so the bigger building in Tacoma, which is a building I've toured, and it's just an amazing building on the inside, is the old City Hall building. And so there's it's sort of like, it's the worst hot potato in property, basically. I've seen it go from group to group to group, from company to company to company to rebuild it. And it got to the point where chunks of the building were falling off onto the sidewalk below. So now you can't walk on the sidewalk next to the old City Hall. And I'm like, okay, but nobody's doing substantial repair work on this. And if the building is literally crumbling, how safe is it? So yeah, I understand the church is I understand the sadness for why the church is going, but on the other side, yeah. I it's a, like I know we don't talk about it very much, but hey, guys, for the record, I think all religions are mainly a conduit of social control and violence. Yes, including yours. Especially yours, if you think you're the exception. All right? I know we don't talk about it very much on a show called Ask an Atheist, because right now there are literally bigger fish to fry. Bigger, orange, whatever. But there's a lot going on, and so we're spending our time, as we should, on these other subjects. But let's not forget why I continue to do the show, why we put the show together in the first place. I do believe religion is mostly a harmful force, and still believe it's mostly a harmful force. And so when you get together and say, hey, let's save a church, no. Are we going to turn it into something cool? No, it's still going to be a church. Yeah, knock it down. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We're out of the break, we come back. Yeah, I need to work on my stamina and my material. Becky's going to come bail me out of this.
Hello, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, where Sam Mulvey is no longer the chosen one, no longer in studio.
Do you stop being the chosen one when you're not in front of the microphone?
Well, yeah, I chose him to leave.
Oh, okay.
He did come down from the mountain at all. Have you come down from a mountain?
No, I'm still way up tall on my mountain of educatorness. Well, Ask an Atheist listeners, you've got me, Becky Friedman. And, you know, because it's back to school time, I'm going to, you know, dig in with some school stuff. Surprise, surprise. Because schools across the district in Lexington, Kentucky are complying with a new state law mandating that In God We Trust be placed in a prominent place in every school by providing framed, enlarged dollar bill pictures for school offices. The district COO informed administrators in July that their general counsel had come up with a recommendation, and Fayette County School Superintendent Manny Kalk issued a statement on the first day of school reiterating that employees were focused on learning and had indeed complied with the law to display the national motto with the framed paper currency. When bill sponsor Brandon Reed complained about the district complying via a so-called loophole, accusing them of denying the opportunity to empower children through artwork featuring the motto, Superintendent Kalk replied, expressing his hope that Reed will continue to bring together lawmakers on both sides of the aisle to address the most pressing needs facing public education, including underfunding of early childhood education and safety resources.
That was one salty cup of soup.
Oh, was it? Mm-hmm. You know, as an educator and as a public school educator, I have always wanted more dollars going into our schools. This is not exactly the way that I've wanted dollars to go in the schools.
It's only $1.
And it's only $1, and it's only a facsimile of it.
Yeah.
And it's only to get around the fact that in Kentucky, you have to display In God We Trust in a place where students will see it.
Mm.
I think that this is a clever and creative workaround. The indignant reply and response to this is not a loophole. Of course it's a loophole, and I commend you heartily for it. Like, it's an amazing loophole, but at the same time, it reminds us all that we've got a religious phrase on our currency. On our yeah. Secular nation has a religious phrase on our currency that was brought there in a way to say that atheists are evil, to say in 1954 that atheists are you know, the godless communists of Russia and the Soviet Union, and we need to distinguish ourselves from that. So, I mean, it's a fun little workaround. Like, I get it. That's cool. I don't know that the students will actually see it as anything other than a dollar. They're not really looking necessarily at the you know, verbiage on it. But I think that it's a nice little workaround.
I'm not sure which one I object to more, actually, having In God We Trust, you know, in a place of prominence in the classroom, or, you know, putting a picture of currency in a place of prominence in the classroom. Like, either one to me is like, is this really what we want to, you know, tell kids that everything's about?
Well, in America, we either worship Jesus or the almighty dollar.
Right.
Well, I thought, whatever happened to the chosen one? King of Israel, you know?
Don't forget all the other religions. Oh, We deliberately do.
They only wanted to see the creative art from the Christian children. All the other children aren't included in this one.
Oh, I'm glad you brought up the art again, because the legislator who sponsored this, he said, he wrote into the bill that he wanted the displays to be encouraged to be like an art contest from students. You know how, like, you can say, hey, make your picture, and then we'll frame it and put it up and stuff like that. And he says, by putting the dollar on the wall, we have robbed the children of artistic expression of Christianity and patriotism.
All right, kiddos, let's see which one of you loves God the most. Make us some art.
And I mean, the guy, the legislator, I wouldn't be surprised if that's the kind of thing that's coming out of his mouth, if not just piping into his mind, because he's the one that said we need this bill because America is a Christian nation, something that not just atheists object to. There's plenty of religious individuals who object to this rhetoric that America is a Christian nation, because we can see that it's leading to this white Christian nationalism, the white supremacy, white separatists, Christian nationalists, and this, you know, this unholy marriage between these really poisonous ideologies that go against the pluralism that can be so beneficial to America and to any kind of nation. And it's the kind of thing that poisons the thinking of, a particular city council candidate in Marysville, Michigan. Can I take us up there from Kentucky to Michigan? Yeah, because we don't want to just write it off as, oh, that's Kentucky and that's Matt Bevin and that's in the South or in the Bible Belt or anything like that. No, this is in lots of places all around our country. A candidate for city council in Marysville, Michigan, stated during a public forum her conviction that the city should remain a white community as much as possible and prevent foreign-born individuals from coming to Marysville. The statement was a response to the moderator's question of whether the council would be more aggressive in attracting foreign-born citizens. Other candidates expressed shock, reminding Jean Kramer of long-standing civil rights statutes and sharing personal histories of immigrant parentage and ethnically diverse families. In a follow-up with the local newspaper, Kramer elaborated on her beliefs of white supremacy by directly attacking the family of acting mayor and fellow candidate Kathy Hayman, calling her family in the wrong. Kramer declared that a husband and wife need to be of the same race, since it's been that way since God created Adam and Eve at the same time. She also asserted that she's not against blacks.
She probably has black friends.
We're not anti-black. We're just really pro-white. That's the same thing.
Something they say all the time, though.
I know.
There are so many things. I want to say that all of the other candidates at that forum really were golden in expressing their shock and outrage. I mean, first of all, there was an audible like, whoa, when this lady said this. She was the first one to answer the question. And then you have people saying, I really don't know where to even go with entertaining this or responding to this. Of course, people of all races and nationalities are welcome in our city. And then even though you have, you know, four or five candidates follow up with saying, of course, everyone's welcome and diversity enriches us. There's a chance for Ms. Kramer to clarify her beliefs, and she doubles down on them.
All out. Like, oh yeah, she's super racist. Like, not just a little bit racist, all racist.
And her racism is being supported and bolstered by her particular religious interpretations, which is suspect because she says that God created Adam and Eve at the same time. And as far as I know, with the two different creation accounts in the first part of Genesis, I don't think that I wasn't Eve created from Adam's rib, which meant that they couldn't have been simultaneous. And so, like, she doesn't even know her Bible, but yet she is perfectly fine using it to justify her separatist and supremacist ideology and then double down on it, even knowing that her opponents are part of, you know, multi-ethnic and multiracial families, and say, no, that's just wrong. That's just wrong with your family.
I mean, this kind of brings up the point that most Christians don't actually know what's in the Bible in the first place.
It seems like a lot of them that will use, you know, the Bible to justify this kinds of things. Although, in fairness, the Bible does justify things like slavery and separation between races and genocide and things like that.
All
another
bad things.
Reason why maybe
don't
you
forget
shouldn't.
Rape.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely that.
Oh, nope. Child abuse.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, if it doesn't make it in your top 10 commandments not to like hurt children, like, yeah, how good is your book actually, right?
Well, I mean, right. Most of the commandments are all about God being, you know, horribly, horribly prideful entity.
But you better not eat cheese and meat in the
nope.
same sandwich.
Yeah, certainly not. So I'm you know, wondering what, you know, where are people getting these poisonous beliefs, and then how are they being emboldened? You know, it can seem like putting in God we trust in schools or on municipal buildings is something innocuous and annoying to people who aren't Christian. But when the sponsor is saying we are a Christian nation, and then people are taking that up and saying, yeah, I like this Christian nation idea, and by the way, I think that we should only have white people, and adding to it in that way, it gets more and more alarming, leading to a lot of the really damaging policies that we have, not least of which some of the activities take place in our own backyard. We've talked about Representative Matt Shea on this show a lot, but newly leaked communications from 2016 reveal more of Spokane area legislator Matt Shea's close ties to a group that trains children and young men in combat to prepare them for patriotic biblical warfare.
Could we just call these guys white Christian terrorists?
I think that we should.
I think that's probably appropriate.
I think the FBI would if they hadn't, you know, been directed to,
yeah,
like, you
to.
Know, defund research into these folks, you know, domestic grown terrorists and things like that. But in an email leaked to the Guardian newspaper by a former Shea associate, Team Rugged founder Patrick Cochran wrote to Shea that everything about the organization is both politically incorrect and would be considered shocking truth to modern Christians. He alluded to training scenarios where trainees would have to fight against Muslim terrorists, which he characterized as one of the most barbaric enemies that are invading our country, and thanked Shea for his support. Shea is already known to have appeared in 2017 video recordings in support of Team Rugged, which trains males in rural eastern Washington, according to teachings of John Weaver, a neo-Confederate preacher based out of Georgia. The videos show young men telling Shea that Team Rugged is a school where men acquire skills that they'll need in order to be effective in Christian warfare, with Shea marveling that their drills made them look like acrobatic special forces teams. Interestingly enough, Shea also paid Cochran directly from his 2018 campaign funds. I mean, there is so much mess with this guy. You have one Republican elected sheriff, Ozzy, in
right.
you know, there that says, please, Republicans, let's repudiate him and get someone else in there. But you have other people associated with the Republican Party, associated with Christian nationalism across the country, that are using Matt Shea and his connections and his associates as models, as guides for what to do.
So he's illegally distributing campaign funds on top of all this, right? That came up earlier.
Yes. He's already been under investigation for those kinds of things within the state. The party is looking at him and, you know, just to see whether he is in compliance with election law for our state and things like that. This is the guy that released the sermon that said the case for biblical
right.
warfare. And he said, no, this is just a sermon. You're interfering with my religious freedom by, you know, misrepresenting this.
So then the neo-Confederate thing really brings up the idea that this is just another group of people that are all about the South rising again.
Which is a weird thing for, I don't know,
right.
this northwest
yeah.
corner
I mean,
of the country?
I mean, if it did, it wouldn't be the South anymore. That's
no,
something
no,
that's
be,
always bothered me about the phrase, like, but the South shall rise again. Well, if it did, it would be the North.
Well,
right?
This particular neo-Confederate is a guy who doesn't necessarily like the South as a geographic term. He's neo-Confederate because he loves and justifies slavery.
Right.
And he has all sorts of colorful things to say about anti-miscegenation laws.
Right, so.
And he's a preacher. He's a pastor. He is using religion to justify his really toxic and horrible beliefs. You know, and you have this elected official that just because he's got an R next to his name, folks say, oh, he's going to be in favor of fiscal conservatism and I'm going to vote for him. You know, when this Team Rugged isn't just about young men, they're taking boys, middle school boys, and and training them in hand-to-hand combat and close quarters shooting.
This is brainwashing.
Absolutely. I mean, we look at the terrorist training camps that, you know, folks have through propaganda been so afraid of, that are, you know, supposedly scattered throughout Pakistan and Afghanistan. Look at what's happening in Marble, Washington.
Yeah, it's the same thing. Just a different religion and a different group of people.
It's tough for me to look at, and it's tough for me to look at that and not see the connections going back to things that seem as innocuous and annoying as "In God We Trust." You know, when you say that our this is just something that we have to go through and put on the wall of our schools, when it comes from folks that have the same wellspring of hatred and of thinking that you know, we're all better off if we're separate and you know, white folks are superior and you must believe in this Christian God, I can't help but say, no, it is worth the fight to say, no, let's get this "In God We Trust" business out of schools and off our money and things like that. I don't know if you share my same kinds of feelings on that, but it's a tough one for me to see, for me not to see those connections, especially when we're looking at people that are training 12-year-old, 11-year-old boys in what to do when apparently some terrorist comes and threatens your Christian identity. You're listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, and you got an earful of me, Becky Friedman. We'll be back after the break with I think some science-minded things.
Sweet.
Hello and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. You can email us at questions@atheist.radio or give us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC. In the meantime, we have got an inquiry from Pastor Ronald, who tweeted at us. You can tweet us at Ask an Atheist WA. Pastor Ronald said, deoxyribonucleic acid, a self-replicating material which is present in nearly all living organisms as the main constituent of chromosomes, is the carrier of genetic information. So how did the info get there? Dan, take it away.
Sure. I actually think this is a really cool question. So deoxyribonucleic acid, for those that aren't familiar, that's DNA. When he says in nearly all living organisms, there's a little bit of debate about that. And the reason has to do with a thing called a retrovirus. Retroviruses replicate using RNA, not DNA. So that would be sort of the exception. And the jury's still kind of out on whether or not viruses are actually alive. But I digress. This is a really exciting question, and one that there's an active area of research about. So abiogenesis is the study of the origin of life. And since all known living things use DNA, excluding retroviruses, the origin of the genetic code is a huge component of abiogenesis research. Now, one idea of how DNA may have come about has to do with its sister molecule, RNA. RNA is a simpler and less stable nucleic acid, but it's the one that gets translated into proteins by other types of RNA. This should give a little insight on one of the hypotheses about how all of this came about. RNA can work with other RNA to self-replicate. Scientists have even managed to create RNA strands that can act as an enzyme to identical strands to replicate each other, a single molecule capable of self-replication using nutrients readily available in the world around them. Over time, natural selection, which is anything but random, could have favored RNA molecules that replicate themselves faster and with fewer errors. Eventually, this could result in the mirror twin RNA strands that make up DNA, and the much more stable deoxyribose as a structural sugar, rather than the simpler but more easily damaged ribose of RNA strands. But why does it code for amino acids that can be stacked into proteins? Well, there's a bit more to figure out there. There are at least three main hypotheses in order to explain how and why. The first one's called the stereochemical theory. Codons of three nucleotides, that is to say groups of either adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, well, three of them together code for a specific amino acid because they have a physical chemical affinity for that particular molecule. With this idea, the code is intrinsic due to the physical properties and couldn't have occurred in any other way. Compare this to like the puddle theory of why Earth is so perfect for the life that lives here. That is to say, it's sort of the puddle asking why it is the shape it is. Well, the puddle pours into the shape and not the other way around. Life evolved to these conditions, not these conditions are perfect for life. Second, there's the adaptive theory. Natural selection of RNA and DNA has made the code as robust and resistant to errors as possible, with a 3-nucleotide codon because it's the least easily mutated in ways that would make it non-viable. The DNA we know today has survived billions of years of improvements to be the current version of itself, while less robust versions have died out and disappeared. Third, there's the coevolution theory, that the code is a result of amino acid sequences that created it. A sequence of amino acids stacks together to create codons of nucleotides, and in turn, those codons of nucleotides code for the same amino acids. This is like taking a car apart in order to make the instruction manual that tells you how to build a car. Of course, none of these are mutually exclusive. It could be any of these ideas, or it could be all of them, or even ones we haven't thought of yet. It might also be just unknowable, since the origin of DNA occurred billions of years ago, and such small molecules seldom leave good fossil records behind. So this is an explanation of how it could have happened. But we're probably never going to know exactly what occurred.
Now, when you say that there's these three theories, the coevolution theory, the adaptive theory, and the stereochemical theory, we're saying that those are kind of models that we've looked at for how something might have occurred. Are they just kind of like random, plucked out of air? Like, oh, I bet this is something that could have happened. Or is there kind of like evidence supporting this by things that we as human scientists have been able to replicate or assess?
Sure. Yeah, there's laboratory evidence from the way that we construct molecules, what we know about organic chemistry and biochemistry, that supports all three of these. There's also mathematical models that support them. So these three are sort of the main hypotheses about not just how DNA could have come about, but rather why DNA is a code that codes for amino acids. But like I said, it could be all three of them together. They're not mutually exclusive at all. It could also be that there's something else that we've not discovered yet, or it could be something entirely out of mind. I will say that none of these really point to an intelligent designer. They once again point to natural, chemical, and eventually biochemical processes.
That's over billions of years.
Right.
Super cool answer to a super intriguing question. We do have another follow-up piece of feedback from John from Idaho, who says, I will co-defenestrate with Sam when the Chipmunks Christmas song is playing. I have no personal favorite Christmas song, but the Ella Fitzgerald Christmas album is muy elegante. And this comes from, I think, something that is surprisingly of interest to atheists of what is your favorite Christmas song, originally asked back in July by listener Megan. Luke, I don't think you have had a chance to join us for revealing what is your favorite Christmas song as an atheist.
Well, generally speaking, I despise Christmas music of all sorts.
Really?
I'm not a fan. Okay. I'm not really a fan.
All right.
Now, I used to really like this one song called Oi to the World by No Doubt, but then I realized after listening to it recently that it's horribly, horribly racist.
Oh, the things that like we take for granted as teens or young adults, and then we come back with different, you know, more educated and insightful eyes and say, ooh, I'm kind of going to distance myself from
that. Yeah, I'm going to push that one back a little bit and when I was a kid, that was neat. But now I'm like, oh, yeah, no. So I'm going to go with All I Wanted for Christmas Was a Skateboard by Super Deluxe.
Okay, I know the two front teeth kind of, you know, All I Want for Christmas, but what is this skateboard deal?
It's a song about wanting a skateboard for Christmas and instead just getting a sweater.
Oh, so material wants and needs,
yes,
for your spiritual Christmas song.
As all young teenagers usually think.
I think that that's probably the most sensical of Christmas songs that we here have mentioned on Ask an Atheist in terms of what is most, you know, in line with, you know, celebrating and receiving gifts and having desires that are normal and human and things like that. You know, if you want to email us, Facebook us, tweet us at Ask an Atheist, we love, you know, dissecting some of your questions and feedback and things like that. Well, you know, even if we aren't the chosen ones exactly. Let's see. I've got one more story, and this comes to us from California, where an anti-vaxxer and failed political candidate allegedly assaulted California State Senator Richard Pan Democrat of Sacramento because he believed that Pan had lied, laughed at his cause, and committed treason for misrepresenting the truth. Kenneth Austin Bennett, who had challenged Pan for his seat during the 2018 primary, unsuccessfully, I'll note, live-streamed a video of himself pushing the senator who was walking with a fellow assemblyman. Bennett could be heard on the video saying that he probably shouldn't have done that, but later captioned the video claiming that Pan got what he deserved and suggested that the senator should be hanged for treason for assaulting children. Senator Pan successfully sponsored a 2015 bill that tightened vaccine requirements for children attending public schools in California and is currently sponsoring a bill that would sanction medical providers who improperly issue medical exemptions for parents opposed to vaccine requirements.
I hope that last part really makes it, that too many doctors end up like passing on or letting people go on with their anti-vax beliefs and just signing away their signing notes and letting them do their thing.
It's a fear that we in Washington have as well, yeah. As just for this school year, we have tightened vaccine requirements for the MMR in order to be able to attend schools. You cannot just say, I'm not vaccinating my kids for personal philosophical reasons.
Unfortunately, there are a lot of ways around that still, and that's a little worrisome. On top of that, where'd the treason come in?
I don't know. And I don't know that the punishment for treason is shoving across a hallway, and I don't know that... obfuscating the truth is a treasonous charge. I don't know.
This worries me, though. This is a bunch of people that are angry and scared, and they literally think that vaccines are killing children, and killing children is bad. Yeah. I mean, across the board,
killing children is bad,
but it does not kill children. Very rarely are these things dangerous to children. You have a very, very small chance of having a reaction, and autism isn't caused by vaccines, and even if it was, would it be better to have a dead child than an autistic child?
You know what does kill children? You know, measles
influenza, all these
polio.
Things.
Yeah, it's
polio.
You know, I think that we are seeing some of those kinds of things, you know, up in Washington, at least not with the physical assaults of lawmakers and medical professionals that are trying to really strengthen our public health in Washington. But if you look at any of the hearings for strengthening these laws, you will see people with extreme vitriol are convinced that this is, you know, a government's way of, like you said, hurting children to the ridiculous lengths to say that it's treasonous. And
that's excessive. They're scared for their children because they believe these things. I understand that. My kids, I care about them a lot. If somebody tries to threaten them, I'm going to be pretty angry. But they've taken on these pseudoscientific beliefs and absorb them into their worldviews, and now they're afraid that their kids are going to get hurt because they're protected from measles.
I think a really important thing is to, like you said, they are scared for their children. You, as someone who likes vaccinations, are also scared for your children,
right,
if they're under threat. You care tremendously about the health and safety and success and thriving of your children. There's common ground there. There is common ground, and if we can crack into the common ground of we care about our children, then I think there may be hope for reducing this anti-vaccine hysteria, you know, that is seeming to pervade certain segments and sectors of parent groups and certain corners of the internet,
yeah,
and things like that.
If we can talk about things instead of yelling at each other, we might be able to maybe lead them in the right direction. It's going to take a lot of work and time.
Well, Dan, Luke, thank you guys for joining us on Ask an Atheist. You can email us at questions@atheist.radio, tweet us and call us at 844-SKEPTIC, find us on Facebook. Our music is by Chris Coleman and Phil Whitfield. Thank you to Sam Mulvey for being the chosen one. We'll see you guys next week.
For he is the quizzer.